like to welcome everyone to one of our first sessions of the day. This is session 212, entitled Mormonism and the Limits of Political Neutrality. Congratulations for surviving your first full day at Sunstone. Today we invite you to celebrate what it means to Mormon as a verb, not a noun. Sunstone invites you to show us how you Mormon. If you haven't yet, make sure you grab a Sharpie from the front desk and write on your name badge what kind of Mormon you are or want to be. You might have noticed the little ellipsis in the space in here, so have fun with it. We're striving to build a community where your authentic Mormon experience is recognized as a legitimate Mormon experience, and you are a part of it. Before we begin, we ask that cell phones are silenced and that those attending will be respectful and attentive. It is the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. Please keep that in mind when engaging in the Q&A portion of the session following the remarks of the presenters. And again, we remind everyone, if you do have questions, to hold them until the end, because we will save some time for a Q&A. Those who cannot abide by those guidelines should refrain from commenting and will be asked to leave should they become disruptive. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. Take advantage of our symposium special by subscribing to Sunstone Magazine. 7 issues for the price of 6 at the registration desk as well. Consider also purchasing Skull Candy official headphones customized just for Sunstone. Wow. Your support goes directly to keeping symposiums and 40 years of thoughtful dialogue alive and sustainable. Don't forget to check out the bookstore in the ballroom, hosted by Benchmark Books. Consider purchasing a book or two to support Mormon studies and scholars. This session is 60 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow for the next session to start on time. As a courtesy to other presenters and our attendees, we ask that immediately after this session you clear the room and speak outside so other presentations can begin preparation for the next session. So now we'll go ahead and introduce the session. Again, this is session 212, titled Mormonism and the Limits of Political Neutrality. Though the LDS Church claims political neutrality, this has not necessarily been the case in practice. Taking a case study approach, this presentation argues that the institutional LDS Church did indeed influence the political sphere in the 20th and 21st centuries through its involvement with the Equal Rights Amendment, Proposition 8, and the October 2016 Mormon Leaks tapes. And we'd like to welcome our presenter, Kelsey Hillesheim. It says in the program, when this was written, she was a senior at the City College of New York, but she's actually a recent graduate of the City College of New York. So congrats, Kelsey. Graduate of the City College of New York in the Macaulay Honors College Program, with an interest in the influence of religion on public policy in the United States. She studied philosophy with a minor in history. So with that, we'll turn the time over to Kelsey.
All right, can everybody hear me? All right. I'm gonna have to do like this. All right, we good?
You can just take it out.
Okay. There we are. All right, great. Okay, so I want to right here?
Yes.
All right, this is good? Okay. Eat the mic. All right, so I want to start out by offering a bit of background on myself as well as the scope of this piece so that we can situate this properly. So I am not, nor have I ever been Mormon, so I'm approaching this topic from an outsider's perspective. And I'm focusing on patterns in the institutional LDS church, so I'm not focusing as much on the individual membership, because in order to write, this is my senior thesis, so in order to do that, you really have to make a very narrow scope. And I'm focusing primarily on the influence on policy in the US, not so much on the global church. So let's start out by discussing. Technical difficulties, oh dear. It was working fine earlier. Aha, okay. So I'm going to make a few key arguments today. And the first is that we're going to look at the clear claims of political neutrality from statements directly from the institutional LDS Church. And then I'm going to analyze whether that was, in fact, being politically neutral in reality. So we're going to look at the juxtaposition between the two. And we're going to look at further the case studies that show otherwise. So I'm going to give you a full description of why. So the first case study I'm going to look at is the Equal Rights Amendment, and then the second is Proposition 8. So before we jump in, I'm going to talk about the historiography of the two. So I have a mix of primary and secondary source material. The ERA case study is a little bit heavier on secondary source material, as more secondary source material exists, as it happened longer ago. And the Proposition 8 portion is going to be more heavily on the primary source documents. Specifically, there were several documents we're going to get to look at on the screen that were released by Mormon Leaks in March of 2017, so fairly recently. And we're going to look then at the rationalization for acting in a political manner, which is predominantly for morality purposes, which is the reasons given. But we're going to look at whether what are the implications of that, and whether that is a full and complete explanation, or whether there perhaps is something more to look at. So let us get ourselves started. So, in the present day, the institutional LDS Church claims to be politically neutral, but I'm going to later show that these claims perhaps don't hold as much water as we think they do. So in the 1800s, the U.S. stood primarily as a Protestant nation, so pluralism, especially religious pluralism, was not very typical of this time period. Catholics were viewed with suspicion, as were other minority groups, including Mormons. And preserving religious liberty was synonymous back then with preserving America's Protestant identity. In 1878, the U.S. Supreme Court heard a case regarding polygamy, which we'll talk about a little bit later, that tested that standard, so we're going to really go up against that. And look at whether the courts deemed what the First Amendment covers under that. So today, the LDS Church's official statement on political neutrality stipulates the following. It claims not to endorse, promote, or oppose political parties, candidates, or platforms, to allow its church building, membership lists, or other resources to be used for partisan political purposes, so not to allow any of those things. It claims not to tell members who to vote for or tell current government officials what to do. Notably, the LDS Church, quote, reserves the right as an institution to address in a nonpartisan way issues that it believes to have significant community or moral consequences that directly affect the interests of the church. So this is pulled directly from the website that is given with the statements on political neutrality. So it's very emphatic claims of political neutrality. But this last one that I talked about offers a fairly wide scope of reservation for using morality as an argument to act politically. So we'll look into how much that's done and whether that is truly being politically neutral. So let's talk now a little bit about the Equal Rights Amendment a little bit more further. So I'm going to pull up here the text to the ERA. You can take a look at that if you like. I'm not going to read it out loud. But this was initially introduced by Representative Martha Griffiths from Michigan in 1970 in August. And this was proposed to be the 27th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. It failed to pass through Congress on the first attempt, but eventually passed both houses on March 22nd of 1972, which then set the clock to give it 7 years to be ratified by 3/4 of the states. And the amendment ultimately came very close to full ratification, but it fell 3 states short. So I'm going to show you a little map here. Of areas where it was and wasn't ratified. So this is mainly the initial ratification portion. And you can see two key areas that jump out to you. So it fell three states short, meaning that either three of these southern states had to pass it, or these three states here, which might look very familiar and may have something in common, also didn't pass it. So the question then is, why, and could what would have happened with there? And the prevailing narrative within discourse predominantly is that southern disenfranchisement, so this region here in the South, where that disenfranchisement among women voters especially was the reason why the ERA wasn't passed. So there is some research done predominantly by people who are LDS who argue that perhaps there was some influence from the LDS Church, and that perhaps if the LDS Church were in favor of the ERA, that we would have it today. So we're going to look a little bit at some of the reasons why people stood in opposition. So there were traditionalists and there were protectionists. So traditionalists mainly stood in opposition to the ERA because they thought that we should preserve traditional gender roles. And protectionists thought that that if we were to pass the ERA, we would lose certain protections, so child labor laws, all those different kinds of things would be altered. And both of these arguments tend to go more toward the traditionalist area. So the prevailing narrative of Southern disenfranchisement, the main reason why I don't quite buy into that, is because of the state of Texas. So if we look, Kyle Goyette wrote a paper arguing that women weren't quite as disenfranchised in the South as you might think they are, that they had a lot of agency, and because they used that agency, they used it to push more for conservatism in the South, and it was a precursor to what we see now and what we see as a resurgence in the 1980s of conservatism. And I don't see that there's a giant difference between conservatives living in Texas versus the rest of the South, and there's some resources on that that I would be happy to share with you all if you would be interested. But there's, I think, an overemphasis on the distinctiveness of the South. With the state, Goyette states that nowhere in America was the ERA more detested than the South, which resisted the amendment on religious, social, and cultural grounds. And that may be true, but my research argues that certain parts of the Wasatch Front region rivaled the South in its resistance. The main difference, though, lies in the fact that the Southern resistance was a very grassroots effort, as opposed to, in the other case, these states with large LDS populations, Utah, Arizona, and Nevada, the responsibility laid in a centralized effort on the part of the LDS Church from the state level. And that these areas both end up rejecting the amendment makes sense, since they both prize traditionalism. But nonetheless, I argue that the reasons for prizing traditionalism are very different, especially because the Mormon sphere of influence historically was very departed from the traditional societal standard for marriage, including Blackstone's coverture, which was not legally part of the history of Utah. So I like to consider the possibility that the LDS Church played a much larger role in preventing the ultimate ratification of the ERA than is typically considered. Overwhelming evidence indicates that the LDS Church had a direct involvement in telling its members what to do. This extended to the LDS women attending the Utah International Women's Year Conference, and these women systematically, as a group, used their agency to shut down every proposal made at the conference, even the ones that they personally agreed with in principle. And Michael Quinn argues that this was because the church sent them to do this and that they obeyed. And Neil Young argues that the women complied out of a desire to prove their value in the LDS church beyond the prescribed gender roles that predominated in the mid-20th century. This actually makes sense given the history of the LDS church and the relative freedom that Mormon women experienced in the 19th and early 20th centuries in comparison to women living in the rest of the United States. So it is worth pointing out, though, that there was a little bit of difference, that some LDS individuals campaigned very actively for its passage. So Sonia Johnson was excommunicated for her work in December of 1979, and she was a founder of the group Mormons for the Equal Rights Amendment. And in Johnson's opinion, an effort to defeat the ERA, church leaders and she, I quote her, turned church meetings into precinct meetings. Nor was she, and she wasn't the only one in favor of the amendment, and actually popular opinion in Utah actually supported the Equal Rights Amendment up until the 1960s. So even as church leaders became increasingly wary of it and more public in that wariness, as per Michael Quinn, there was still a lot of popular support. So what changed? What made it become something that everybody was very much against? When the church initially came out against it, there was a lot of arguments between members, but despite sharing these doctrinal beliefs, the division over the amendment occurred primarily along political party lines. So if you were Democrat, you were generally in favor, etc. The LDS Church justified involvement in blocking the ERA because they viewed it as a threat to the broader moral issue of gender relations. Church leaders felt they could remain politically neutral while engaging in the political sphere because they understood the roles of men and women to be a moral issue in society. This meant that officially resistance was not political, it was moral. So this becomes a question that I'm going to bring up. So we can talk about, there was definitely involvement in that that we looked at with Quinn's paper. And from there, the moral issue argument was the main justification. But the problem with that argument is that if morality can certainly be a justification for acting politically, but it's not grounds for claiming political neutrality. Logically speaking, you can't be both politically involved and politically neutral at the same time. There's a bit of a problematic logical issue there. The question of morality is irrelevant here because the argument itself, while technically is valid, is not necessarily sound from a philosophical point of view. But the rest of Quinn's paper does cast doubt on the political neutrality issue, as it's discussed today. So he argues that the early church never really operated in a politically neutral manner, that political action was integral to the way the church functioned. Going back even to Joseph Smith in August of 1833, when he received a revelation that proclaimed Mormonism as a separate and fully sovereign entity within the United States, meaning that he could build a theocracy, essentially. But that even when everybody moved out to Utah, that the church leaders actively endorsed candidates who usually won. Even after Utah's territory became a state and there was the official rejection of polygamy and changes that occurred with statehood, that the general authorities still, they exercised an outsized influence on politics in the region. So, and this is demonstrated in the quote from Brian Fisher, who was a co-sponsor of the ERA initially in the state of Utah, but who changed his mind. He said, "It is my church, and as a bishop, I'm not going to vote against its wishes." The significance of this statement, aside from the obvious shift in point of view, is that a legislator said on public record that his religious leaders had changed his mind. For this reason, it is impossible to say that church and state were necessarily completely separate in Utah in 1975 during the whole ratification process. But even as we accept that political neutrality never really belonged to this history, that a paradox emerges when we view the church's stance on ERA as a moral issue for the preservation of gender roles, mainly because up until the mid-20th century, the actions of the church did not indicate that they necessarily favored traditional gender roles. In fact, reality was often to the contrary. Up until the 1920s, Mormon women enjoyed freedoms unavailable to women from the rest of the United States. They were afforded suffrage, equal access to higher education, including professional degrees to become doctors and lawyers, the opportunity to successfully run for state offices, to no-fault divorce, and the legal ability to successfully file for it, and the ability to do what they were best at in the domestic sphere, which included handling finances, something that women were not allowed to do in the rest of the country, instead of what gender roles at the time prescribed for the rest of the U.S. And because of polygamy in the Utah territory, women were not held to Blackstone's common law marriage ideal of coverture. Women were also generally allowed to speak about issues of significance to them without suffering repercussions. When Emmeline Wells publicly renounced Victorian ideals and sensibilities in support of equal partnership in marriage, she was duly rewarded with the Relief Society presidency. However, from the 1920s onward, the LDS Church's leadership came to adopt those Victorian ideals that they once were against. And so the question then is why? And I propose that the reasons for this were mainly to belong, that it had very little to do with any sort of moral issue, that was mainly a cover for an attempt to achieve long-desired acceptance as part of a Protestant in-group that so long oppressed them, and thereby achieve acceptance in American society at large. The present cultural narrative generally accepts relatively strict separation of church and state, but that hasn't always predominated. And as we discussed earlier with the Reynolds case, that Mormons and Catholics were vilified as outsiders, and Mormons even more than Catholics, that Mormons weren't even accepted as fully white, so there was a quasi-racial demotion as well as a religious discrimination in American society. And the main argument in the Reynolds v. United States case from 1878 was that people could believe whatever they wanted, but the First Amendment doesn't protect all religious practice, and polygamy was one of those non-protected religious practices. But the reason why the court rejected polygamy is very interesting to me, because it's not out of any idea that it was inherently harmful to women, but rather that it was just morally inferior to the Protestant ideal of monogamy. And that was what made it wrong, not that it was not any other sort of reason, simply because it was not what their own standard was. So there's a very strong Protestant hegemony that existed in that period that very much influenced the way everything was understood. So given this history of stigmatization, it makes sense to want to become integrated into American society once and to gain full acceptance. And so adopting ideals of the rest of Protestant Christianity at the time would be a way to see, look at us, we're just like you too. Perhaps you can accept us as part of your America and also allow us to gain political power and influence within your America. So in order to gain this legitimacy in the eyes of outsiders, there was a need to abandon some of the things that made Mormonism so distinctly different. And political involvement on the national stage had more to do with joining the Protestant club than with moral conviction, regardless of whether leaders themselves were even aware of it at the time, if it was a subconscious thing or a conscious thing, that it nonetheless happened, is what I argue. So that's my piece on the ERA. And now let's talk a little bit about Prop 8. So for those of you unfamiliar, Proposition 8 was a ballot proposition in California in 2008 that had the purpose of effectively making gay marriage illegal in California in perpetuity by affirming marriage as something exclusive to heterosexual couples. So in this, there is very clear evidence of involvement from the institutional LDS Church, evidence of which I will present to you right now. So there were two areas, the first of which was funding and the second of which was mobilization of members. So several major news outlets offer some numbers on donations and what that may have looked like. So according to the New York Times, members of the LDS Church were decisive in mobilizing support for Prop 8, financially and with boots on the ground. There was a donation from Alan Ashton, who's grandson of David O. McKay, which reached about $1 million in size, and that money, together with $5 million in other donations that they raised pretty quickly, helped to deal the final blow to Prop 8. The Mormons were not the only group involved with this effort, that's very important to note, but they were the last group to join in. So Catholics and evangelicals were already very active in this, but jumping in as well and adding that fresh blood to the ring, as you might say, was enough to tip the band in the scale in the band's favor. There are also articles from The Atlantic suggesting that the scope of the church's financial involvement exceeds far beyond the $6 million that the New York Times reported. There's some work from The Atlantic that claims that it could have fallen anywhere from 40% to 77% of all funding. And Fred Kroger, who is of the group Californians Against Hate and is very well known for kind of criticizing the LDS Church a lot. He came at a 77% figure, while the Wall Street Journal was a lot more conservative and said it was probably around 30 to 40%. But still, those numbers are not insignificant. And these were all to the Protect Marriage Coalition. So that's where that was all donated. And there was also an advertising blitz put out by the institutional church. So that's also worth noting. And there was also, so if we look at that thing that happened, the rationalization again was that it was a moral argument that we need to preserve heterosexual marriage as some sort of moral reason, for some moral reason, as opposed to any other reason. But I argue that maybe there was something else behind it, that it was, again, perhaps to belong. So there's, in 2011, as you all may remember, there was a very big I'm a Mormon ad campaign. So this was a PR campaign launched by the LDS Church to change public perception and give people other ideas besides just shows like Big Love and all those things that many people would mainly think of, and so that you could see Mormons are people just like you. They're your neighbors, they're your friends, they're, and they are as diverse as you are, in a sense. So that included, you know, all sorts of different professions, so people talk about everything. So we're going to talk, though, mostly about some primary sources, which I'm going to pull up in just a second. And these were the primary source evidence leaked by Mormon Leaks on March 23rd of this year. And I analyzed two of these sources, the first of which is a handout, and the second of which is a PowerPoint presentation. So I pulled some slides from that, and then we're going to pick apart a couple bullet points together. Mm-hmm. So it's another piece of evidence toward the broader belonging narrative that even after Prop 8 was passed, that there was a need to push out a campaign that would be say, no, we are just like you. There is, yeah. So can you all see? Okay. It's a little bit small, so I'll read the portions that I want to really pick out. Out loud to you all. So this is titled Proposition 8 Volunteer Outline. And I think this offers some really interesting insight into some of the rationale for this mobilization effort. So bullet 4, I want to kind of pick out for you all, which is right down here. And I'm going to read that for you. The portion that I really want to pick out says, "We are being asked to canvass the neighborhoods and telephone voters, not to persuade or convert, but only to determine how they will be voting. This approach is non-confrontational." To me, that appears to be interestingly contradictory. The very purpose of canvassing is to persuade people of something, usually something political in nature. And a face-to-face approach, like the one they describe, is inherently political, because asking someone how they intend to vote is a political action. And then in the sixth bullet, there's also a precedent for the passage of a bill like Proposition 8, arguing that a yes vote on Proposition 8, as I quote, reinstates the democratic voice of the people. The problem with this is that it implies that the will of the people cannot change. As we go further down, indicators of the longing narrative begin to emerge. Among them is the claim on the eighth bullet down here that we, quote, "we will be outspent in the media by at least 2-1, but we have the volunteer advantage." That appears to be a bit of an us versus them statement. And then the second page, which I want to pull up for you all here, this one's a little bit bigger, so you might be able to read it for yourselves a little better, but this page contains arguments on the third, from the third bullet to the end, pretty much, that saying that the issue at hand is not the existence of same-sex couples, but that the problem is that there's an objection to applying the word marriage to those relationships. So this is a very interesting thing I want to point out. Further, if you look closely enough, you can see that the words same-sex marriage are in scare quotes. And that was something that I saw as an interesting parallel to some of the texts produced by evangelical groups. Carrie Brittany of the University of Hawaii analyzed a bunch of materials from evangelical groups that were very prominent. So this included groups like Focus on the Family, the Family Research Council, Family Research Institute, and the National Association for Research and Therapy of Homosexuality, or NARTH. And this was an analysis of the issues section on her on the Family Research Council's website as of 2010. And she analyzed the use of scare quotes around the word marriage there, arguing that this choice of punctuation is significant in that it seeks to delegitimize same-sex marriage, mocking it as something that can never be equivalent in legitimacy to heterosexual marriage. So you can see that there, that that's placed within quotation marks, and I thought that was very interesting to notice. And that parallelism might have similar implications here, that a marriage between members of the same sex could never be a quote-unquote real marriage, as one might say. So now we're going to talk a little bit. I also want to point out that there is, if we go back, a bit of an invocation that this is a part of your faith, that you must do this, because there is a quote from Boyd K. Packer, I believe, right down here, that they use. This was produced, this is internal from the LDS Church that was leaked by Mormon Leaks. These were all internal documents. Yes. To the volunteers, yes. This is volunteer. Mm-hmm. Wow. Nice. Thanks for being here. All right. So this is a piece from the PowerPoint there, which has a lot of very similar languaging that just reinforces some of the languaging we saw earlier. So that's worth noting as well. And I especially want to emphasize the idea that that they're saying that we're not taking away from anything from LGBT plus people of California, that we're only making sure that we're protecting what already is, that this traditionalist idea. So, and that's just a reinforcement of what was in the volunteer outline, but I wanted to put that up there simply to show that that was in the PowerPoint as well. So it was said more than once. It was seemed to be pretty reinforced. So this is these are a couple slides from the PowerPoint, and there's some interesting things I want to point out on them. So on this is the Our Goals page, which is pretty much the first real page of the PowerPoint. Yeah, this is from the Mormon Leaks, yeah. It was given, I believe, this is an internal, to present to the volunteers. So I don't have every single slide up here, but it gets very detailed, down to very nitty-gritty details of who's going to be doing what, when, at what time. Here's how you're going to document exactly what you must do. Yeah? But I would love to chat. This seems really, really interesting. I'm getting really interested. Thank you. No, thanks for sharing. Absolutely. But we'll flat through. We'll get there, I promise. All right. So the Our Goals page lays out a lot of intentions for And then the methodology that I think is very clear states, it is not our goal in this campaign to attack the homosexual lifestyle or to convince gays and lesbians their behavior is wrong. The less we refer to homosexuality, the better. We are pro-marriage, not anti-gay. And this language is very laced with assumptions. At first, words like lifestyle and behavior imply that homosexuality is a choice. At the same time, wording here concedes that voters in California no longer see homosexuality that way, which is very interesting. If they did, there'd be no reason to avoid referring to the existence of LGBT plus people, as people would just agree with them, and that would be that. Another purpose of this presentation is to describe ways to assuage fears of people who are uncomfortable with the process of canvassing by expressing specific concerns of theirs, including embarrassment, performance, and commitment. And there's a section called Fear of Performance, in which the following statement is made. Explain that they do not have to persuade, only explain what Proposition 8 is and identify the voter's position. And that segment contradicts one of the specific main goals of the campaign, which is to persuade. Perhaps this means that the individual making the call didn't have to act persuasively, even if persuasion is the goal of the campaign, so it seems to be very intense in that way. And then there are also, I'm going to show you this lovely organizational chart. So this is how well organized everything was. This is an organizational chart that explains the interplay between LDS Church hierarchy and the goals of the Protect Marriage Coalition and exactly how everything's going to play out. So it was spent a long time looking at this. It's very, very interesting how everything all fits together, that there's an ecclesiastical side and a political side, which just is very, very clear to me. But I also want to point out these roles included, and I'm going to list every single role that they talked about so that you can see just how many different roles there were. So there were identifiers, messengers, closers, trackers, walkers, which included knockers and stickers, schedulers, recorders, emailers, networkers, monitors of media, blogs, or polling places. So there were three different kinds of monitors you could be, distributors, speakers, writers, diplomats, and registrars. Each of these roles is accompanied by a description of what type of person would be best suited for each role. And finally, scripts are offered for conversations to put volunteers at ease. So I'm going to show you here. This isn't all the roles, but this is just what, under the phoners heading, who would be good for what and what they would have to do. And it also, I found it interesting too, the identifiers point is saying the point that we're looking for here is the quote-unquote mushy middle, which will be the main targets. So people who don't say definitely anything. If they say definitely yes or definitely no, they're probably not going to spend too much resources. But if you say probably yes, undecided, or probably not, there will be resources expended in that direction. So finally, let's talk a little bit about the scripts. So they kind of read like a choose-your-own-adventure story, where each answer has its own designated response. So on the 23rd slide, there's responses that might point to the success of the campaign. So if it'll say, and I quote here, if definitely yes and voter is married, ask, does your spouse agree with you? If definitely yes, ask, would you be interested in helping with the campaign, such as displaying a yard sign or making a few phone calls? So mobilizing people even beyond the scope of the membership, so that it just becomes an outward-reaching branch. And I'm struck by the outward focus of those questions, that it's beyond the individual with whom the canvasser speaks. If they can elicit a positive response to either of these questions, they open the door to an exponential amount of reach, especially if someone agrees to the second request. Some components, so let's also look here one more. I got one more document for you all. So this is also on that PowerPoint slide, and this goes a little bit more into, you know, trackers, monitors, et cetera, and what they all do and what they're going to do on specific dates, August 16th, 23rd, and September 6th, and who's going to do what when, and what everyone can do, and if you're not comfortable with certain things, maybe you can do other things, like supply things for the people who are doing these roles, like offering food and water, offering out your home. So it's not, so in summary, I'm going to recap everything here. So despite clear claims of political neutrality, the institutional LDS Church at least in, especially in the 20th and 21st centuries, is not truly politically neutral. And that the justification of morality still doesn't negate the fact that there's political activity, and that all political action is political. You can offer moral reasons for said political action, but that doesn't make it any less political. For example, people who picket abortion clinics say they are doing so for moral reasons, but it's a political action nonetheless, and they generally tend to acknowledge that. Further, evangelical and Catholic groups that do mobilize people to do that do not deny that that action is political, and tend to embrace political action as a part of their duty as Christians, all the while acknowledging that it is political. So there is strong political action, but not out of any moral obligation, but as a deeper desire for full acceptance within the mainstream. So these strong political involvements against causes shared with conservative, evangelical, and Catholic groups serve to separate the LDS Church from the specter of its history and enjoin it to what essentially became Protestant hegemony. And in turn, the LDS Church itself became more mainstream as members of its faith became increasingly visible in politics and culture, which kind of culminated in what we refer to as the Mormon moment surrounding Mitt Romney's 2012 presidential campaign. It is this striving for acceptance that I posit led to an increase in ostracization of church members who may go against the grain, whether by being intellectuals who question church doctrine, by being feminists, by being members of the LGBT plus community, or by embracing members who are part of those groups. And further, that this political activity affects broader U.S. public policy by influencing policy outcomes, and it has broader implications even beyond the LDS Church. Because everyone enters a political situation with their own worldview and set of biases derived from that worldview. And this explains the increasing demonization of viewpoints different from our own. We're not just disagreeing, but we're disagreeing on touchy subjects that cut to the core of who we are. Without making a sincere attempt to openly discuss how these worldviews and values affect the policymaking process, we'll continue to be left without nuance in our understanding of U.S. politics. So the elephant has always been in the room. It's about time we discuss its presence. Thank you. So,
questions? Okay. Thanks, Kelsey. We'll go ahead and open it up to questions now. So if anyone has anything, if you would come to the front and speak into the microphone, just a reminder that the session is being recorded. So, oh, we have a, here we go.
This one we can pass around.
Mic swap.
Okay. Questions?
So I supported the ERA and anti-Prop 8, but...
Oh, well, sorry.
So if your thesis is that the LDS Church is hypocritical in not maintaining its political neutrality, I think you need to be very careful, though. The statement said that it was neutral on partisan parties and candidates, but that it speaks out on moral issues. And so if you're questioning whether their activities in these areas don't really have a moral foundation, then I'd really like to know, other than, well, they want to belong, I think that's a weak argument. Mm. What is the political reason that they took those positions? If you look at politics as the art of the possible, in other words, it's the exercise of power and trying to gain power, what is the political motivation for them taking those actions, as opposed to politics being a means to influence policy changes because of a moral position? While I disagreed with their activities on Prop 8, I certainly never questioned that they came from a moral perspective. So I'd just be curious on your
absolutely.
Reaction.
Absolutely. I think that that's definitely part of it. But it becomes kind of a circle of things in the sense that you can't, without being accepted as part of the mainstream situation, that you don't gain a ton of, you don't gain a.
The public opinion did not show us definitely one way or the other. I mean, mm-hmm. Who were they trying to join other than the evangelicals, who were a small portion of them?
But they also are highly influential, as the past election showed. That without their support.
It would be interesting if you did the same analysis on Romney's run.
Yeah, that would be very interesting.
Activities at an institutional level to support him, and I'll bet there were, though I personally don't know. and then also compare that with what they did or didn't do for Trump.
Yeah, that would be a very interesting thing. That would be kind of like expansion into dissertation level stuff. But yeah, there's an interesting, and you bring up a very interesting point that I've kind of thought about a little bit, because it's a challenge to really know to what extent everything is, to what extent this is really like strong in the sense that there's always that in it's kind of. How do I connect? They're very connected. They're very intertwined in that that from what I've seen, politics and religion are kind of inherently intertwined in a very interesting way, because what your views on certain issues are necessarily affected by what your worldview is and what you believe about the way the world is. And
So compare the church's activity on Prop 8, where they got their butt burned, okay, and their non-involvement in the, you know, recreational marijuana initiative that just passed. I asked numerous times, you know, church officials, not general authority types, if that's not a moral issue, what is, and how come you're not involved? And they did nothing. They did absolutely nothing. And I think, personally, I'm against recreational pot. I think that's a travesty. Explain it.
I have a question and a comment. I noticed that you used the elephant in a room analogy, and I wondered how much partisan politics had to do with the ERA as well as the Proposition 8, whether the Democratic Party took a predominant position or the Republican Party backed off or what? That's the question. The other comment is that it seems over time that the goals that liberals had have been achieved, in the sense that courts have systematically ruled that there cannot be discrimination on the basis of sex, and same-sex marriage has been passed by the Supreme Court. So I guess the observation is that the goals of those who opposed those or who supported the ERA and opposed Proposition 8 have been achieved through social change and then change in the law.
Could you rephrase that second question? I wasn't quite clear on what you're asking.
Well, it's not a question, just an observation through social change, which then influences legal change.
It's very interesting.
The courts of the change, those goals have been achieved.
That's a very interesting
Maybe
observation.
Future goals
Absolutely.
Will be achieved that way. I don't know.
And I believe you asked a question at the beginning, but my memory is a bit
faulty. Your allusion to the elephant in the room.
Yes.
And the Republican Party.
Oh, yes, right now I remember. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. So, absolutely, I think you're right on that point, that there is absolutely a partisan divide, even more so now than there was in the past, but that it's become very much that way. And I think that the religious elements are just have become folded into partisan components. So if you look at even other groups, at the moment I'm reading a book on the history of evangelicalism and how that became folded into the Republican Party and the idea of a moral majority, that there was a lot of political stuff going on with that, but it's that they all became folded into it, that the politics became a means to, that becomes very difficult to separate it all out. And so, but I think partisanship cannot be ignored, so I think you bring up a very good point.
We saw that hand first.
Hi there. I'm interested in, I have often thought that the political activism by the church, especially during Prop 8, sort of opened up a Pandora's box to allow regular members to activate politically against the church itself. And I'm wondering, like, if you did any research on that thesis, whether being politically active and sort of using church institutional structure to push the Prop 8 agenda has led to then sort of permission for members to then be politically active. And I'm thinking particularly of, you know, Kate Kelly and like the feminist political movements that have happened that have targeted the church and then allowed church members to be politically active themselves and direct that political activism at the church.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very interesting point. I didn't focus as much on individual members just to keep the scope a bit narrower, but I do see where you're coming from, and I think that's a very interesting point. I'm also interested in, I think it's interesting that you bring that up because it's interesting to look at, you know, what happened after that, if people maybe saw it as a permission, but then it, the way it became, that the institutional church's reaction to those kinds of activism was also, it's also very interesting in that, that they're saying, they're essentially, with the way that they're, with the series of excommunications and shutting down, it's like saying, saying, no, actually, you can't do this, that only we can do this. It becomes a very interesting thing to look at, for sure.
Sorry, Gottlieb, you did comment on, because it seems like, not formally, but informally, the American church is now recognized as the most loyal force, or the most loyal group of Republican voters. And I remember having a bishop say, talk about the true political party. So on an informal cultural level, it seems to increasingly have identified with one side. I was wondering, is that outside of the United States, where we seem to be culturally really identified with conservative Republicans, is outside of the United States, are we much more culturally neutral, or do you know?
I focused most of my research on within the United States. That's where, just because that's where I needed to narrow the scope to a certain point. But I think that's a really interesting thing to look into in the future, and I'd love to discuss it absolutely if anybody has commentary.
I haven't lived in Australia for a long time, but I go back frequently, and the church is more, well, it's very marginalized at any rate, but the members of the church are not as conservative and would not, in Australia, the conservative, not called conservative, but the conservative and the Labor left-wing party, Liberal Party, are fairly equal. It's my observation, and I gather pretty much the same in New Zealand. But that's a pretty minor group in Australia. But that's, yeah. Yeah.
Get my steps in today.
Hi, Kelsey. My name is Kimball. I really like your suggestion that politics and religion have some kind of relationship. And I'd just like to suggest that it seems to me that politics are even a subset of religion. For example, the formative story of the Bible, the story of Exodus, involves a god in Egypt, Seth, who is the god of the evil Pharaoh. And the god Seth supports that heavy-handed monarchy. Then along comes out of the wilderness the god of Moses, who likes freedom, and he self-identifies himself as the God who, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the house of bondage in Egypt, and I brought you into the wilderness and back to Canaan where you can be free. So it seems that, at least in the Judeo-Christian tradition, our God, the one God in heaven that most believe in, is sort of a democratic-oriented God. But that's not specific policy issues. That's more on the basis of what kind of government system and how well are people enfranchised. So I think really politics and religion are deeply entwined, and sometimes it's not inappropriate for religion to step into politics or for politics to have a say-so in religion. So I'm sorry, that wasn't really a question, but I wanted to support your idea that there is a connection and it may not be all bad.
Yeah, thanks for sharing. That's very interesting. And yeah, absolutely. That.
One more question. I got the last one. So question, I was surprised, like this gentleman, that you put the premise was to belong. I think I get it a little in the first bullet around the ERA.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were such a small force, I guess, and mm-hmm. nobody took you seriously. But in the second one, I was a bit surprised about mm-hmm. that. And I guess my question to you is, what I hear you saying is that we wanted a place at the table to have a voice in the national arguments of these political pieces. And it sounds like we've had two, I don't want to say failures, but failures. And what do you think is the future? You know, like, are we a voice? And, you know, I guess what's the, if you are being invited to the table and now you're at the table, like, what are we doing with that? Because I don't see mm-hmm. a real, and to your point, you know, we pick and choose and the membership really doesn't get any voice in it. Somebody just gets a bee in their bonnet and goes after something and then they rally the troops. And you look at it, we have the money. You have, I mean, I think a lot of organizations really are envious of what we could do. You have the ground roots, you have the money, but yet it just seems like we don't have a strategy. And we're at the table, but nobody understands the strategy, and we pick and choose.
Yeah.
I guess what's your thought about, you know, what's the future of that, I mean, based upon this?
On the case, that the federal case that was brought in San Francisco, which, by the way, the judge was gay, the opportunity to present the arguments of the impact on society and family and everything which were outlined in all their political guidelines, that opportunity was presented to the plaintiffs, and the church supported the litigation but did not pick the lawyers and apparently was not at the table to help prep the witnesses. And the witnesses were destroyed. They could not present acceptable evidence to the judge to support their claim that all the negative effects that this was going to have. That was their opportunity at the table, and they missed it. So which tells me they have great ideas, but they're lousy on implementation, and which results in the liberals getting what they want through the court system and not through the political process. And that may come from a desire to play in the political arena, but still be not real comfortable with it. Okay, and which then goes to the issue of, well, then political candidates. So I just had to throw that out because they want to play, but they're not very good.
That may change, though.
That was kind of my question. Yeah. Do we see an improvement? Have we learned the lessons? Are we backing out?
They learned,
or are we going to double down and go forward?
They got burned. Push agenda. Like, probably. They really feel they got burned, and I think that's why they didn't get involved in the pot stuff.
I help. We help.
Kelsey, any final thoughts?
This has been pretty great. Thank you all for coming out.